Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Endocrinologist Dr. Matthew Leinung joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from Albany Medical Center, where he serves as director of the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism. He earned his medical degree from Wake Forest University, completed his residency at Greenwich Hospital in Greenwich, Connecticut. He's a specialist in endocrine disorders, including diabetes, thyroid disease, pituitary disease, adrenal disease, osteoporosis, and treating transgender patients. Dr. Leinung, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I know that you are one of the most in-demand physicians in the Albany area, and they're lining up, and there aren't enough endocrinologists to go around, so we're flattered to have have an hour with you today. If anybody wants to talk to you, this is the time to do it. I have a lead-off question, and I'm going to ask you this. How come so many people have diabetes?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the results of progress that we've made. To be honest, we're no longer in a situation where we're functioning as hunter-gatherers. We're now in a situation where we have plenty of food readily accessible. We have calorie-dense processed foods that's readily available. And this creates a situation where it's very easy for us to get overweight, develop diabetes, and there has not been an evolutionary chance for us to adapt to that yet.
Interesting. So when somebody comes to you and they're either pre-diabetic or diabetic, what do you tell them to eat in a day? What diet do you put them on?
Well, there's no specific diet. There's the general diet that the American Heart Association, the American ADA recommends, which is a basically healthy diet that provides the calories that you need. Typically, we're in the 2,000, 2,400 calories per day, with a mixture of carbohydrate, protein, and fat. The carbohydrate should be mostly in the less processed realm. So in other words, not things that have a lot of sugar, but the less refined carbohydrates. But we do need all those components in the diet. So attempts to eat only protein or only fat and no carbohydrate or only carbohydrate.
I've been on all those diets.
Right. And basically, they can induce some weight loss, but not one of those diets is better than another for inducing sustained weight loss. It really does amount to how many calories you take in.
So as my twin brother Lewis used to say, three things on a plate. See, we always would argue, I believe in one thing on a plate. So he would believe in three things on a plate. You know, your green, your protein, your carbohydrate.
Well, that's a similar mix to what we're talking about.
Yes, I know.
The basic components are carbohydrate, protein, and fat.
I was agreeing with you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you could also say three things on the plate, and one's a spoon, and one's a fork, and one's...
That's great. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Carolyn. Okay, Carolyn, your turn.
Wow, first one this time.
You're good.
Question about subclinical hypothyroid treatment with levothyroxine or Synthroid. Couldn't make myself take it every day. Took it three times a week. Got my blood tested. It was good. Then I cut back to 2 days a week. Blood tested good. Cut back to 1 day a week. Wasn't good. So I'm taking it twice a week. With my doctor's okay. I really want to get off it. I'd rather be on Armour Thyroid if I can get it, a compound that's properly standardized. And what is the possibility of that and the usefulness of exercise and proper rest in helping support the thyroid?
Here we go.
Okay, so there's a bunch of things that you've brought up. The first is, what is subclinical hypothyroidism? When the term subclinical is used, generally they mean a very mild form of whatever the problem is. So subclinical hypothyroidism would be that there's evidence on the blood test that your thyroid levels are not quite up to where we think they should be, but you do not have overt clinical symptoms.
I can hardly hear you. I don't know what the problem is.
Well, just keep your head close to the telephone.
Okay, I'll try to speak a little more forcefully.
And I'll put it into Zachary, too. He'll keep you. Well, he says he already is. Go ahead.
So this is a situation where you don't have overt symptoms that we can identify, but biochemically it looks like your thyroid is not producing quite enough thyroid hormone. There's debate about whether we should treat that. I tend to fall on the side of generally treating it because I think the absence of overt clinical symptoms doesn't mean that physiologically the body is not looking to have a little bit more. And it's very easy to provide thyroid hormone therapy with very little risk as long as you're monitoring it. And that's easily done with blood tests.
Now, there are a lot of people who have one form of this disease in this country, aren't there?
Thyroid hormone is one of the most widely prescribed medications in the country. So the number of people in the United States with hypothyroidism is up in the tens of millions at this point.
Wow.
So it's very common. And most people are hypothyroid because of some autoimmune process in the thyroid that has interfered with thyroid production. Years ago, we used to have iodine deficiency in some areas in the country, and that could lead to hypothyroidism. But the salt that is used in processed foods and that you buy in the grocery store is iodized now, so we don't see iodine deficiency as we used to, let's say, 50 or more years ago.
Yeah, I just remember all those little bottles with the skull and crossbone.
Right.
On them for iodine.
So the other issue you bring up is how to prescribe thyroid hormone, and you mentioned Armour Thyroid. Armour Thyroid is from the Armour, initially from the Armour Meatpacking Company, where they would take thyroids from the slaughtered animals, then desiccate the thyroid, and then prescribe that based on weight. Now, the issue with this is that if you're taking slaughterhouse thyroids, you can say, well, this is natural thyroid hormone because they're getting it from thyroids. But the components that are in there, you don't know the ratio of T4 and T3. T4 stands for, it's got four iodine molecules on it. T3 has three. They are both called, quote, thyroid hormone. T3 is considered the active hormone. T4 is a sort of pro-hormone, but it's not quite that simple. But when you're taking a desiccated thyroid, it's based on weight. So you may have iodine, you may have T3, T4, you may have metabolites of T3 and T4 that are not biologically active. So a number of years ago, companies began making T4. The companies can also make T3. And then prescribing that based on the fact that we know exactly how much thyroid hormone you're going to be getting. Normally, the thyroid makes mostly T4 and some T3. The body converts T4 to T3. So we have found through decades of administering this that providing people with T4 is generally sufficient. And the synthetic type, which would be Synthroid, Levothyroid, Unithroid, there's a couple different brands out there, is exactly the same chemical, exactly the same formula that the thyroid makes. So the body can't tell the difference whether you've eaten it or your own thyroid has made it. And so that's why generally the recommendation is to not use the desiccated compounds, but to use the ones that we know exactly how much is being prescribed.
No long-term side effects?
No, because actually this is not a drug, it's a replacement hormone.
Okay, so it won't make the thyroid stop producing, or whatever it is, the pituitary, stop producing what it needs to produce to make the thyroid run properly?
Well, it does.
If you're taking a medicine?
It's a good point you bring up here as well. It does actually impact on what the thyroid will do. Now, think of the thyroid in your body, which is directed by the pituitary, small gland at the base of the brain. Think of that kind of like the furnace in your house or your apartment. And so when it's cold, the signal goes from the thermostat to the furnace. It says, make more heat. Mm. What we've got there is a feedback loop. And so many systems, many endocrine systems run on what's called a negative feedback loop. So if I, for example, start taking thyroid hormone right now, as long as I don't take more than my thyroid is going to make on its own, my pituitary will sense it. It will turn back on how much I make because I'm now eating some. And it will regulate the level so it stays, like your house does, at, let's say, 72 degrees.
Gotcha.
So, yes, if you're taking thyroid hormone, you may be taking a little bit more than is the deficit your thyroid needs, but your own thyroid will adjust. the pituitary and the thyroid will adjust. Now, the final thing you're saying is, can I ever get off thyroid supplements? We do occasionally see people that have this autoimmune thyroid problem going on, and occasionally it'll wax and wane. Most people, once they become hypothyroid, tend to stay hypothyroid, and that's pretty much it. But there are some people that we've seen who are in the subclinical realm, and, you know, if we follow them over many years, sometimes they come back with normal levels, sometimes they progress to overt hypothyroidism, and there's not a great way to predict. You can measure thyroid antibodies, and that sometimes gives you a clue, but it's still not in any individual case.
And you haven't heard of anything related to exercise and rest, or even the amino acid tyrosine assisting in a healthier thyroid without use of supplements.
You bring up another.
By the way, we're about to hit a mandatory block here. So can you just?
Yeah. So I'll just say the final thing is that there are goitrogens in diets, things that can affect thyroid function. But in the diets that we have here, which are many different foods, generally, no. There's nothing specific to do with your diet. Tyrosine is an amino acid in any kind of protein you eat, so supplementing it is not necessarily going to help.
That's great.
Okay.
And thank you. Carolyn, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, a team of four uro-oncologists with 75 years of combined experience providing advanced robotic surgery for kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer. UrologyOncology.com. Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, community hospital for over 100 years, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of LaTower, working to help put patients at ease with colonoscopies. NLH.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. Watson & Associates, Occupational Hygiene and Safety, providing comprehensive hygiene, safety services, and training for industrial, commercial, and governmental facilities, safetyiselementary.com. The Montessori School of the Berkshires, dedicated to engaging the natural curiosity of children, toddler through eighth grade. Now enrolling for fall 2016, berkshiremontessori.org. And Proctor's, presenting Deepak Chopra's The Future of Well-Being based on mainstream and alternative medicine. Tuesday, May 3rd at 7:30 p.m., proctors.org for tickets.
And we are back, and we're very lucky because we have a very rare fellow who can join us today. Usually he's just working, Dr. Matthew Leinung, and he is at the Albany Medical Center, where he's director of the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism. Okay, I got a fast one that came in over the internet. Doctor, from Barbara, it says, side effects of Prolia. My thumb joints really ache, and the shape of the bones is changing. Thanks, from Barbara.
Okay, so Prolia is a medication relatively new. It's a monoclonal antibody used to treat osteoporosis. Like all monoclonals, these things are antibodies that are directed against certain proteins or enzymes in the body. In this case, it's directed against a compound that is involved in bone turnover, and that's how it has its impact on osteoporosis. For most people, this is well tolerated. There are some people who report some skin problems, a sort of dermatitis that develops with it. Beyond that, and some increases in pneumonia, not certain exactly how that comes about. For the most part, most of the other complaints that are listed, you know, when you submit data to the FDA, are all just a few percent, and we're not that much different than people taking placebo.
Or what you hear at the end of the ad on the television.
Yeah, then that long list of everything, you know, from making your eyeballs turn green and fall out, whatever. The issue, though, with something like Prolia is given every 6 months. Yeah. So once you take a dose, there's really nothing you can do. You can wait the 6 months that it's effective and then see if some of these symptoms stop. So in other words, instead of taking the shot the next time it's due, after 6 months, try stopping it and seeing if that gets rid of your symptoms.
Now, there were some, especially, you know, for bones, which a lot of people have problems with. There were a couple of meds that you got once a year or every half a year, and we don't do that anymore for some reason.
Well, no, actually, the once-a-year bisphosphonate,
that's
which is
the
called
one.
Reclast,
yeah,
that's
the one.
That's still heavily in use.
Really?
Yes, it's very convenient. People don't have to remember to take it. It's an intravenous route, so it doesn't cause the reflux that the oral bisphosphonates have been associated with.
Huh.
So Reclast still has a fair amount of use. It lasts probably longer than a year. So for convenience sake, it's actually pretty popular.
Uh-huh. And no unwanted results that you know of?
There's a lot of press that's been out there about osteonecrosis of the jaw and atypical femoral neck fractures, which is totally overblown. To be honest, the risk for an atypical fracture is probably 300 to 500-fold greater than the risk that you'll actually prevent a routine osteoporotic fracture by taking the medication. Now, that being said, what I will say is you don't want to overuse the bisphosphonate medications. So there should be a good indication for it, and your physician should be following how long you've been on it and what sort of a response you're getting.
Okay, thank you for that. We'll go to Nicole. Okay, Nicole, you're on, Nicole.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was diagnosed with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's about 2 years ago. I was told I have antibodies for both, and at the time I was hyper, and then throughout the last 2 years, I have gone hyper, hypo, hyper. I mean, it just goes back and forth. And as I'm sure you can imagine, my symptoms go back and forth, a lot of varying symptoms, literally from my head to my toe. And it has been debilitating at times where I almost feel like I have the flu, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you've heard it all. So right now I'm on methimazole. I was on PTU, got switched to methimazole, and I'm still struggling. So I guess my question is, A, do you have any suggestions for me? B, do you think I can possibly be more proactive with my endocrinologist? Because she's great, but at the same time, it's my symptoms sometimes change weekly or monthly, and I'm only getting blood work done every maybe, you know, 3 months. And so I struggle with symptoms in the meantime before seeing her. And then C, do you think I possibly need, like, some kind of supplemental medical service, like a functional medicine doctor, because it is autoimmune and not just endocrine? Do you think that I should be going down different avenues?
So, as background, Graves' disease and Hashimoto's thyroiditis are both autoimmune processes involving the thyroid. You can have both. Typically, someone gets the process of Graves where it stimulates thyroid production and they become hyperthyroid, or they get the Hashimoto's and typically they become hypothyroid. We do see instances in which people can have those antibodies, which some are stimulating, some are blocking, and the amount of the antibodies can wax and wane, and you can go from hyper to hypo. Now, that being said, thyroid hormone has a long half-life, so changes in how you're feeling. You know, if we suddenly start someone on thyroid hormone, suddenly stop someone on their replacement, it's going to take weeks for those symptoms to really begin to manifest themselves. So you're on methimazole right now. One of the approaches that could be tried is to give you enough of that medicine that it absolutely turns off all your thyroid function and then give you back some thyroid hormone in a steady dose that then keeps you on a more level keel. What I tend to do, and I think a lot of endocrinologists do, is if someone is in a situation where they're bouncing around because of the autoimmune nature in this, at that point we say, well, let's do definitive therapy, which we call ablative therapy, which is either surgery to take the thyroid out or radioactive iodine to destroy the thyroid. Then that way, whatever autoimmune process is going on with the thyroid, we've taken the thyroid out of the picture, and then we can give back the amount of thyroid hormone that you would need to have a normal thyroid level. So in your situation, if this has been bouncing around for a year, 2 years, that's the approach that I would look into taking, doing some sort of definitive therapy.
Nicole, we're going to let you go. A lot of people behind you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Joe, my poor eyes are having trouble with the numbers on top. If you could make those a little bit. That's number three. Yeah. Okay. And we'll go to Joe in Coxsackie. Okay. Joe, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I'd like your opinion on metformin for borderline A1C, 5.7, 5.8, 5.9.
Okay.
Two endocrinologists love, suggest it, and two primary care doctors say it's not indicated.
Okay. So A1C, that's a measurement of average glucose. So people with diabetes tend to run levels, the definition is greater than 6.5. A normal A1C is 5 to 5.5 in that realm. So we use it diagnostically and also to follow how people are doing. So you say you're at around 5.7, 5.8. There are some people that think that this pre-diabetes, so that's if you fall between, let's say, 5.5 and 6.5, that those people should be treated. And in fact, if you take something like metformin, which we use for diabetes, we will see an improvement in the A1C and the blood sugar numbers. Now, at this point, it's very hard to say that there's any real benefit by treating in that circumstance. Now, there was a big trial a number of years ago that looked at slowing the progression to overt diabetes by using metformin. Interestingly enough, what they found was that it was not as effective as diet and lifestyle. So the take-home message for many people was, okay, you're in this warning range. You know, it's like the yellow light. So let's do something to prevent diabetes where we know there are complications. And some people say, well, if you give metformin, then you're lessening what is a healthier and safer approach, which is to say lifestyle, whereas other people are saying, well, look, the people have already tried lifestyle, and maybe that's not working, so perhaps we should go ahead and start treating in that realm. I don't treat a whole lot in that realm because I do try to really enforce that people do the diet and the lifestyle, everything that they possibly can. Now, conversely, if I see the numbers are drifting up and starting to get worse, I don't necessarily wait until we hit some magic number like 6.5 on the A1C.
But the metformin also, I just read something interestingly, that it has some off-label benefits. Did you see that?
Metformin has been around for a couple of decades now. It gets used in something called polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a situation that females can get into where they typically have abnormal ovarian function, infertility, obesity, prediabetes, and the metformin sometimes helps with the insulin resistance and can actually improve fertility, for example.
But, Doc, there's no reason you can't do both, right? I mean, you can do both lifestyle.
Well, of course you can.
Metformin, yeah.
Of course you can. And some people say, but as soon as you start throwing a pill on it, people, human nature has a tendency then to kind of like, oh, okay, well, I'm on the pill now, so.
Absolutely. I saw a guy eating once. I knew he had diabetes, and I said, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? He says, I take the pill.
Yeah.
So that's now, exactly what you're talking about.
Now, in an individual case, that may not be the case. There may be someone out there who is still as good as possible and then, despite that, is still headed towards. So that would be a situation where I would consider using it.
We thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Daniel in Pittsfield. Daniel, your turn.
Thank you. So I'm a 31-year-old male. I've been taking thyroid medicine for just about 2 years now. And I was told that thyroid levels should be lower for people who take thyroid medicine versus someone who just has a normal thyroid. I was just wondering if that is true, and if so, how come?
Okay, I'm not aware of any data or reason for people to say that if you're on a diabetes pill, you should be hypothyroid.
Or thyroid medicine.
He said thyroid. In other words,
right, so someone on thyroid. No, we always strive to have people have normal thyroid levels. The only instance where that might not be the case is someone who is has active thyroid cancer, for example, and there may be some very rare tumors, glioblastomas, for example, that may have slightly improved survival when the patients were made slightly hypothyroid.
So, Matt, how do we know as individuals, if somebody tells us our thyroid is out of whack, how do we know if it's cancer or a regular thyroid problem?
Okay. Thyroid cancer does not present with abnormalities of thyroid function. Usually presents as a mass in the thyroid. So if a mass gets felt, then that's the risk. Yeah. In terms of function for the thyroid, remember I talked about that thermostat.
Yep.
We can do a blood test for something called TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. And that is us being able to look at the thermostat. So we know what a normal TSH is, and the TSH tells us what that person's body, that person's thermostat, is telling us about the thyroid levels.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348. Do I have to hang up on somebody? I don't know. 1-800-348-25. I'll try it, see what happens. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Now we'll go to Akasha, I guess it is. Akasha, in Ashfield. Number five. You're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, thank you both for being there. I'm very grateful. I tomorrow, actually, I'm seeing a new endocrinologist for diabetes. I haven't seen one for maybe 15 years, and that was for a prolactinoma, not for diabetes. And I've had hypoglycemia. I've crashed since I was a kid. I have diabetes in both sides of my family. People lost limbs and eyesight and stuff. And a primary care told me years ago to get the where you test yourself.
Right, a glucose meter, home glucose meter.
And I have through the years. I am on disability now, so I haven't been able to afford it for a couple years, but I did it regularly, and I have had a very healthy diet and lifestyle for decades. And I, when I crash, I literally crash to 50 and 48. And I have a neurologist because I have neuropathic disease. I already have diabetic neuropathy. And he did the two-hour glucose, not the six-hour one I did as a kid, but it's a two-hour 75 milligram, and then they test you in between. And he said I was only one number away from full-blown on that, and for the A1C, I had moved up to six. And he explained it, because I don't understand how I could have neuropathy without being full-blown.
Okay.
And so he described it, but I go see this new woman tomorrow, and I don't know how to, like, evaluate her as she's evaluating me, you know, to see if this is the doctor I want to go to.
Okay. So,
am I making sense?
Yes. And what I would say, any time a patient goes and sees a physician, how do you evaluate them? And, man, that is a tough question, but I can offer this advice. If that physician is able to sit down, pay attention to you, talk to you, answer questions, and you're able to understand what they're saying, and, you know, by asking questions, even if they say, well, there's no answer to that, at least you understand that they've heard what you said.
Okay.
So I think that is very important because, no, there's no way you can go in and say, well, how do I know this physician is really great on this? But what you can do is know how well that physician is going to talk to you and listen to you and explain things to you, because it's a partnership. When you're taking care of a chronic disease, this is not a one-time stop and pat you on the back, fix it, and send you out. This is a long-term management of something, and you both have to be on the same page in order to get the results that you're looking for. Now, that also, you brought up the point of you sort of had not been diagnosed with diabetes, but the neurologist says you have diabetic neuropathy, and we do occasionally see this. In other words, people whose diabetes has not really been appreciated or didn't appear to be that bad, and yet they get some of the complications. We don't quite understand exactly why that happens, but we do see it. As a general rule, the people with complications are the ones that have had poor control, but it's not always the case. Another thing to remember is that neuropathy, which is to say that damage to the nerves where you can get pain, you get numbness, etc., that's the only way the nerve knows how to respond. So whether it's from diabetes or a whole host of other causes, sometimes is not clear, because all we see is the end result, and we can't tell, well, was this diabetes? Was this something else? I would assume that your neurologist has looked into all these other causes.
He has.
Okay. When you see this
biopsy, he said it was an axonopathy, which is common with diabetic neuropathy.
Right. It is, and diabetic neuropathy is one of the commonest causes of neuropathy, but certainly not the only one. When you see this endocrinologist tomorrow, all I can tell you is tell exactly what has been going on so that you said it was a she, so she can evaluate and take a look closely at what's going on. Because dropping low, having true hypoglycemia in the absence of therapy is very unusual. And that in and of itself should maybe send off.
Yeah, it's scary when it happens.
Hey, we've got to let you go. Thank you very much,
Akasha.
Thank
you very much.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
For WAMC comes from Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's, and eczema. UVA and UVB sun protection, ProtexGloves.com. HPA LiveWell, Albany, New York, providing intensive outpatient psychological services for treatment of eating disorders in and around the capital region. AlbanyHPA.com. Ellis Medicine, working to create a culture that helps nurses professionally and personally. ellisnurses.org for more information. Mount St. Mary's College, Newburgh, introducing a new criminology major at a day-long transfer admissions event for all degree programs offered. Wednesday, April 13th, 10 to 7, msmc.edu. Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. And the United Way of the Greater Capital Region's Carpe Diem Seize the Way, seeking to address local issues like hunger, domestic violence, and kids in crisis. Donations stay local. UWSeizeTheWay.com.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for being back with us, and we are delighted that you are. The lines have all been loaded. We ask that you ask your question as quickly as you can and then give us a chance to talk to somebody else. Okay, we'll go to Susan in Red Hook. All right, Susan, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, and you sound a lot better, Alan. I hope you're feeling better.
I am, much better. Gargle with salt. That's all it takes.
Okay. I went to ask the doctor what his opinion is of adrenal fatigue. And the reason why I'm asking this is I've been through to an endocrinologist. My GP and my endocrinologist have all done workups on me. My thyroid, all the panels are fine, the T4, the free T4, the T3, the TSH. They checked me for Raynaud's, and I don't have that. I'll tell you, I've gained about 20 pounds in the last 5 years. I've always been in relatively good shape, you know, and I'm constantly fatigued. I have cold extremities and sometimes numbness, and even though I've tried to, I try to watch my sugars and my fats and my carbs. And when I work out, I will tell you that after that initial adrenaline rush and or endorphin rush, after, you know, the hour after you've worked out, I could just pass out.
Okay, so okay. Susan, let's leave it at that. Let's leave it at that and get some kind of a reaction.
Right.
From
so
that.
Adrenal fatigue. The concept here was that, you know, borderline testing for the adrenal, just like subclinical hypothyroidism, maybe there's a subclinical adrenal state or adrenal fatigue. And people have been trying to look into this now for quite a while, but I think the data is in, and basically there is no such thing as adrenal fatigue. We do see early adrenal failure, but the testing picks that up. We've got tests that can tell when someone is headed towards, and again, it's generally autoimmune adrenal failure. So the adrenal fatigue also, there's no therapy that if it were subclinical, like subclinical hypothyroidism, we'd expect certain response with certain tissues, et cetera. And basically, we don't see that. So as a matter of fact, I was just at the National Endocrine Society meetings recently, and this was one of the topics that came up. And yeah, there's pretty much a resounding no from the endocrine community about adrenal fatigue. I would suggest the symptoms that you have, something else is going on, because if indeed you've had adrenal tests that look normal to the endocrinologist, then that's it.
Yeah, I'm concerned because my mother was hyperparathyroid.
Okay, another endocrine issue.
But I'm fine. My parathyroid is fine.
Right, and there's no connection familial with hyperparathyroidism and adrenal issues.
Susan, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Bob. All right, Bob in Leaves. Okay, Bob.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a 65-year-old male, and I've been taking desiccated thyroid for my dead thyroid for about 30 years. And every once in a while, my doctor will say, well, you know, you're over 60, so you really should be on the synthetic, the levothyroxine. And I say, no, this is working now. This keeps working. It hasn't done me any harm. Why change?
Okay, that's the question. Now we're going to get the answer. Go.
Okay. In general, I agree that we go with the synthetic because we know from lot to lot exactly how much is in there. It's also true that there are some people that are very wedded to the formulations they've taken in the past. As long as every time he checks the thyroid levels, nothing's out of whack, you know, there's no point in hitting you over the head with a hammer and saying, you got to do this.
Okay, very quickly, Doc. Desiccated means what?
Oh, it's like the armor thyroid we were talking about earlier. It means they take the thyroid, let's say from a slaughterhouse, and they desiccate it, and then they grind it up.
Okay, and then grind it up, like your grandmother might have done with, you know.
Yep. Or if you're stuck on a desert island and you're hypothyroid, go out, kill a few mammals, get your thyroid, you're all set.
Assuming mammals. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go to Lou in Huntington. Okay, Lou, 1-800-348-2551. Lou, go ahead.
Okay, hi, doctor. Thank you very much for covering this topic. I'm being tested for my parathyroid because of my aches and pains and tiredness. And the levels keep coming very close to the high point of normal. And they're just... doesn't seem to be an answer.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, how do you go about testing the parathyroid when the labs come back normal?
Okay. So the parathyroids are, generally there's four glands that are next to the thyroid, hence they got the name parathyroids. And the only thing they're involved in is regulating calcium levels in the blood.
Right.
And so if there's a problem with the parathyroids, we see it as an abnormal calcium level. Now, typically what people can get is hyperparathyroidism, where there's one or more glands that becomes hyperplastic or becomes an actual adenoma, which is to say a benign tumor, and it makes too much parathyroid hormone, which then causes calcium elevations. It can cause problems with bones. It can cause kidney stones. Those are the two main things we see. It's also associated with ulcer disease, gastric ulcers. And generally, we follow the course of the disease by following your serum calcium levels. If the serum calcium levels are just up a little bit, that's you're asymptomatic, and we don't necessarily have to do anything. If the calcium levels come high, you can become symptomatic. You can become fatigued and just not feel right. Generally, that's easy for us to pick up. We measure parathyroid levels. They're high. We say hyperparathyroidism, and we send you to a nearby local surgeon who's skilled in the technique of removing the offending parathyroid tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So the way to follow it is with your serum calcium levels. And if they're only mildly elevated, then they're not causing symptoms of fatigue or feeling tired. They could have effect on your bone, and that can be assessed, but that's a separate thing to follow with hyperparathyroidism.
And when they take it out, then what do?
Well, the remaining parathyroid glands are still fine.
I see.
And so for the most part, then parathyroid function becomes normal.
That's great. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And we'll go to Jerry in Hillsdale. Okay, Jerry, you're on.
Hi. I'm male, just about 74 in a few weeks, catching up to Alan. thyroid about 3 years ago. TSH was about 7 or 8, as I remember. It took maybe 6 or 7 months to get it, to figure out what the right dosage was. Then settled on the generic thyroid medicine. About last December, my nipples started to hurt, became very tender.
Both sides?
It was mainly the right side, and the left a little bit. No other things, but just the tenderness. I read and stopped taking the generic, saw something that said, you know, this can happen with generic. After about 10 days, went to the doctor and started on the non-generic, and it's been fine since. Why the difference between the generic and the non-generic?
I'm a little surprised that there would be a difference between them, a difference big enough to cause an issue. The only time we really think that the generic is not good is if we have someone who's athyrotic, meaning the thyroid's totally out. Let's say they have thyroid cancer and that's the treatment, and then we're trying to very closely prescribe the amount of thyroid hormone. And the generics are allowed a plus or minus 10-15%. The non-generics, you know, they're plus or minus half that, roughly. So you're a little bit more controlled in the dose that you're getting. Now, when you talk about nipple tenderness, what you're talking about is perhaps something called gynecomastia, which is development of some breast tissue in a male. And that can be painful. Generally, it's pain behind the nipple. There may even be lumps that develop behind the nipple. And that is very commonly seen in boys at adolescence, temporarily, and it's normal. When we see it in grown men, it's pathologic. Now, maybe something simple like medications, et cetera, but if that persists, we generally need to investigate that because it could be an indication of some hormonal imbalance or something happening with medications that you're taking. Now, the thyroid does have an indirect connection with a substance called prolactin, so people that are hypothyroid can get elevated prolactin levels, and that can change hormone levels and sometimes lead to a little painful gynecomastia in males. But, geez, it's hard for me to imagine why just changing from generic to non-generic with the same similar kind of dose. I'm wondering if something else was going on.
Okay.
The only other thing I'm on is Avastin injections into my eyes for macular degeneration. I don't know if that has any impact.
I'm not aware of that having an impact on it.
Jerry, wish we could talk more, but I got to let you go. Thank you. Okay, we'll go to, we'll go to Frederick in Colony. Okay, Frederick?
How you doing? Yes, I've been with my thyroid since 2000. I was 46 at the time. I was just kind of curious, you know, with, is there any other thing that could be affecting the thyroid or affecting something else, you know, besides the thyroid? I have a problem with low white blood cells. Does that have anything to do with it?
No, not directly. And I'll say that when people are on thyroid hormone replacement, then all the symptoms and problems that you can hear about with hyper or hypothyroidism should not be an issue. So, for example, if someone's thyroid doesn't work, they're on thyroid hormone, and we get a phone call. Oh, the medicine for the cold, it says if you have a thyroid condition, don't it? And I'm like, no. You're on replacement. Okay. Your thyroid levels are normal, so that anything else that's going on, anything else going on medically at this point, I would say not the thyroid.
Frederick, thank you. Okay, Laura just wrote in and said, can you comment on the potential effectiveness and safety of anti-sclerostin drug and other new treatments for osteoporosis?
Okay, so she's talking about something called sclerostin, which is a protein involved in bone metabolism. There are trials underway for monoclonal antibodies directed at sclerostin. They are very promising. And may actually be anabolic for bone, which is, if you follow this field at all, you know, that's kind of the holy grail. We have Forteo, which is somewhat anabolic, but we have plenty of anti-resorptives. We would love to have additional anabolic agents. This is one that's very promising. I can't comment on safety yet because these trials are still underway, and the drugs are have not even been submitted, I think, to the FDA for final approval yet.
We had somebody, Matt, who asked about Forteo, I believe, in black box. Black box indicating that the drug company says this could be a dangerous drug, right?
Right. And that's because when they were doing clinical trials and they gave rats large doses over long periods of time, there was some osteosarcoma that developed. That's a bone cancer.
Right.
Now, the Forteo drug has been out over 10 years, and the companies were required to do post-marketing surveillance. And so they followed how many cases of osteosarcoma have developed on the drug. And what they found was, so far, the cases are there at the same rate that they are in the general population. So in humans, and this is human parathyroid hormone that they're giving, when they gave it to rats at very high doses, some of them developed osteosarcoma. In the humans, we haven't seen an increase in that.
Mm, interesting. And if somebody's ever called somebody like me a rat, we have to avoid that drug?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go. Let's go to Rich. Okay. Rich, you're on. Go.
Hi. I had a question about osteoporosis. Just developed that, and I was just wondering, would you recommend any kind of aggressive intervention, like higher doses of vitamin D and exercise and supplements, boron, and that kind of thing?
Okay. We recommend exercise. I recommend vitamin D levels to be in a good level, which is to say probably somewhere between 30 and 60. If some is good, more is not necessarily better. So no, I don't take higher doses. Same thing with calcium in the diet. Some is good, but more is not necessarily better. Trace minerals such as boron and strontium and molybdenum, etc., they're in the diet, and we do not have evidence that giving them actually makes any difference. So I think as long as you have a healthy diet, you're probably getting the trace minerals that you need.
Rich, thank you very much. Okay, we'll go to John in Pittsfield. Okay, John, you're on.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm probably going to be the last caller. I'll be as quick as possible. Maybe you can get someone in after me. My concern, doctor, is are you aware of any research or have you treated anyone with complications of their adrenal gland secondary to Lyme disease infection or infection by one of the known co-pathogens?
Okay, good question.
If so, what laboratory tests would you order to do to find evidence of that?
All right. So, going to answer this quickly. Basically, we can assess adrenal function pretty well. I talked about a little earlier that in terms of adrenal fatigue, if the adrenals are not functioning correctly, your doctor, an endocrinologist, certainly can determine if that's the case. Now, in terms of co-infections, there are some viruses and some fungi, et cetera, that can infect and cause adrenal failure. But again, we measure adrenal function, and then that's how we pick it up. So there's nothing specific that's been attached with Lyme disease to the adrenals.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, very quickly then, we'll go to Brian in Woodstock. Okay, Mr. Brian in Woodstock, you're on.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you, Alan.
You got to go quick because we have no time. Go ahead.
My partner has a thyroid issue that also is diagnosed as possible Hashimoto's. And she has a hard time waking up from 7 to 9 a.m. It's like a coma. So I'm wondering if there's a cortisol issue there, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, cortisol is the main hormone made by the adrenals, and that's what we measure when we're looking at adrenal function, the main form of adrenal function. She had trouble in the morning due to adrenal problems, she would also have trouble during the rest of the day. And the testing that we do for the adrenals would pick this up.
Okay. Well, I'm so sorry, Brian. We're out of time. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Okay. I also want to thank Danielle of Greenwich, who also had an adrenal question, but we're not going to be able to get to her today. Thank you, everybody, who's called in today. Great questions. Don't you think, Matt?
Indeed.
Dr. Matthew Leinung, for joining us. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes with the Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically-assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for information. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy, where calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Again, thanks to all. Stay tuned now for a news update.